You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
Today we're going to be talking about William Shakespeare.
Oh, God.
I know. A lot of you look forward to this about as much as you look forward to root canal work.
When I was assigned to read Shakespeare as a high school student, it didn't make much sense to me either. Maybe that's because nobody in Omaha spoke in iambic pentameter, or maybe it's because I didn't have a teacher quite as charismatic as Robin Williams in Dead Poets Society.
Now, many of you have seen Shakespeare done very much like this. Oh, Titus, bring your friend hither.
But if any of you have seen Mr. Marlon Brando...
No, but Shakespeare can be different. Friends, Romans, countrymen. Let me rest.
And that's right. It wasn't until I left home and saw Shakespeare performed that I finally really got it.
Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand?
That is the wonderful Ian McKellen as Macbeth.
Come, let me clutch thee. Have they not? I need to see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or art thou but a dagger of the mind?
Performances like McKellen's give breath and blood and sweat to Shakespeare. Great actors performing are Shakespeare's characters incarnate, alive. So that after that first 5 or 10 minutes of linguistic confusion, you slip into the world and understand. But there's more than one way to clutch a dagger.
Oh, is this a dagger which I see before me? Or a pizza? Pizza.
That is an actor named Rick Miller. For more than 15 years, he performed a one-man show called Mech Homer. And it's a pretty faithful version of Macbeth.
Hark, who lies in the second chamber?
Malcolm!
Dope!
This week is the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death. So we're devoting this whole hour to what we make of Shakespeare today and what Shakespeare might make of us. It's not just on stage where swords are drawn and poison prepared. Some of the biggest drama these days is offstage. Last year, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival announced it was commissioning what it called modern English translations of Shakespeare's plays. And I gotta say, when I read that, I was kind of appalled. You know, dumbing down Shakespeare.
We often don't realize how much we miss because it's not as if he's using words from Polish.
Right.
They're the words that we know, but so often we don't know what he meant.
That's John McWhorter, the Columbia University linguistics professor. He actually convinced me that some updating of the plays is a good thing.
In King Lear, Edmund at one point describes himself as generous. And you think, okay, he's talking about giving away things readily, which doesn't make sense given what he's talking about at that point. Generous meant noble then. Now, that's not a matter of poetry. It's utterly opaque. We can't know. That needs to be changed to noble.
You say that Shakespeare was an entertainer, loved crowds and people of all classes and education to enjoy his plays. So I guess you think he'd be all down with this.
He would be very down with this. I mean, this is really, I consider this to be almost a smackdown argument on this. Imagine Shakespeare with us and don't imagine him in black and white or as a static, you know, portrait moving along. Imagine him as an actual living, breathing, sweating person. Shakespeare would be depressed to watch us sitting and pretending to understand 1/10 of King Lear and going to his plays often as a kind of duty. I'm not saying that's all of us, but there's certainly something there. He wouldn't approve of that.
Since the early talkies, movie directors have done their part to make Shakespeare more understandable, hiring matinee idols and starlets to perform adaptations of the plays. But even recently, not everybody has been encouraged to audition.
I actually was told by a casting director when I first got out of Juilliard, at a major studio.
That's the actor Wendell Pierce.
And said, you know, I couldn't cast you in like a Shakespeare movie because there weren't any black people back then.
Really? Did you say Othello?
Right, right. I said, you know, as bad as Shakespeare was, he could not just make up
Yeah.
Aaron the Moor and Othello. You say crazy things like that and then perpetuate other mythology because, you know, you would think everyone in ancient Rome and antiquity of Greece were all British men
yes.
with RP from the
exactly.
West End.
Exactly.
Oh, Autolycus, I am going down to the Senate today and I
True.
Hope, will Socrates be there?
You know what's worse than the misconception that black faces don't belong in Shakespeare? Shakespeare in blackface. Well into the 20th century, minstrel shows in vaudeville with white performers in blackface were popular and even respectable. And those old minstrel show travesties were the ways that lots of people first encountered Shakespeare's plays. A few years ago, the producer Richard Paul dug up one thread of the strange story of Shakespeare's plays interweaving with American race relations.
First thing you need to understand for context is this. In the mid-1800s, if you were a seamstress or a longshoreman, Shakespeare's plots and characters were not strangers to you. Othello and Desdemona were as well known then as Homer and Marge or Tony and Carmela are today. But when you went to the theater, more likely than not, the Othello you saw wasn't this.
Yet I'll not shed her blood, nor scar that whiter skin of hers than snow, and smooth as monumental alabaster.
It was more likely this.
Now, do you know this piece? You can easily learn it. The plot is Othello, a jealous Moor, runs off with Desdemona. Seizes her, strangles her.
I guess I'll play Othello.
It was Shakespeare done minstrel style. Francesca Royster teaches English at DePaul University.
Shakespeare's American life is very closely intertwined with the performance of the minstrel shows.
Minstrel shows generally featured whites in blackface playing stereotypes of African Americans along with other ethnic humor.
If for my wife, your daughter, you're looking, you'll find her in the kitchen, busy cooking.
What's that you say? My daughter is your wife? You damn black rascal, I will have your life going, Rodrigo.
Professor Royster says these Shakespeare parodies allowed Americans to explore some of the toughest issues around race.
Struggles around fears of miscegenation, issues of slavery, for example. What to do with immigrants like Germans and Irish. How are those immigrants integrated into the binary opposition of black and white.
This material, Royster says, was drained of its danger when it was put on stage and mocked.
And I love my Desdemona away, away, and hand in hand we'll take a stand to spend Brabantio's money away.
But while there may be things away, for an historian to appreciate about minstrel shows, the fact is this was white people with cork on their faces playing the fool. That's probably one of the many reasons why the African-American sense of ownership when it comes to Shakespeare has been supremely conflicted. Kellyn Sennett Jennings is a professor of theater at American University in Washington, D.C. She also wrote a play called Playing Juliet, Casting Othello.
To be a black American woman saying Juliet's lines, thou knowest the mask of night is on my, and crows and references to the blackness being evil and ugly and bad. Any person of color is going to have to wrestle with what that means.
And yet, Professor Jennings says, it's the beauty and mystery of Shakespeare's work that even while it can oppress, it has also served as a foot in the door.
Shakespeare has often been used by African Americans as a way of proving worthiness.
The earliest example of this came in 1827. Slavery had just ended in New York, and an all-black production of Richard III opened at an ice cream parlor in Lower Manhattan. Shane White is an Australian historian.
Here's a bunch of blacks, many of whom were ex-slaves, performing Shakespeare on stage. Blacks who are struggling to make ends meet. And what do they do when they become free? Well, many of them will try and learn how to read and write. And some of them, in this case, will go out and perform Shakespeare.
They were called the African Grove Theatre Company. They were so successful, a rival white theatre owner had the actors arrested, I guess you could say for performing while black. One of the Grove's performers, Ira Aldridge, ended up going to England, where he lured people into the theatre, thinking they were going to see a minstrel show, and then blew them away with his performance of Othello. That's the real Othello, Shakespeare's Othello.
Aldridge becomes, you know, the most famous black actor of the 19th century.
He'd also play Shylock and Richard III in whiteface. it would be 150 years before a black man played a white Shakespeare role in the U.S. That happened when Joseph Papp created Shakespeare in the Park in New York in the 1970s. Papp instituted what was called colorblind casting, allowing actors like James Earl Jones to play King Lear.
None does offend. None. I say none. I'll able them. Take that of me, my friend, who have the power to seal the accuser's lips.
It was revolutionary to think that a black actor could say these lines and the play have nothing to do with racial tension or racial issues. It was simply the fact that this black actor was a person. What a revolutionary idea.
Colorblind casting was the thing to do for 10 years, but in the 1990s, there was a backlash.
I would much rather that they do art that is of their own specific ethnic or racial background.
The playwright August Wilson waged a campaign excoriating colorblind casting. He suggested that blacks playing whites was really no different from a minstrel show where whites played blacks.
It denies the individual standing on a stage representing another race of people, denies him his own culture.
Wilson felt that if producers could hire black actors for any role, they would stop funding plays by black playwrights about authentically black characters.
You're taking black talent and you're empowering black talent, if you will, at the expense of black theater.
If whites want to possess their culture, he suggested, let them. Now that African Americans have their own cultural capital, they don't need to borrow Shakespeare. Kim Hall is a professor at Fordham University. She says she hears this argument all the time.
This kind of idea that, A, it doesn't belong to African Americans, and from more, you know, I don't know what to say, political and progressive circles, this idea that you should be working on African American authors.
Who does Shakespeare belong to in America? It seems glib and easy at first to say Shakespeare belongs to everyone, but in a way, the African American experience with Shakespeare may be the best evidence that it's true. As Maya Angelou has famously said, speaking here on the BBC's Every Woman program,
it's got to be a black girl who wrote that. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state and trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate. See, that's a black girl.
Since that story first aired, both Maya Angelou and August Wilson have died. Richard Paul's original reporting was done for the Folger Shakespeare Library's radio series, Shakespeare in American Life. Still ahead this hour...
To bear or not to bear, that is the question.
Hamlet, as you've probably never heard him.
Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a say of troubles and by opposing, end them.
The way Shakespeare originally sounded.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. Shakespeare's complete works amount to around 1 million words. Pretty daunting. But you know what's about 3.7 million words, and while we're at it, mind-numbingly dumb? The U.S. tax code.
The taxman's taken all my dough.
Some mystery and narrative tension, but no jokes or romance or death scenes at all. This year, Studio 360 wanted to make the annual tax-paying ritual a little more entertaining, so the staff and I issued a challenge to take the main tax return form, the 1040, and do something creative with it. And you guys rose to the challenge. We got some terrific entries, such as the one from Kimmy Ramone, who made a papier-mâché tax rabbit. And Ann Martin made this bluebird necklace out of a form, a 1040 form, that she cut up and beautifully coiled. You can see both of those and lots more at studio360.org/defile. I would really hate to have to pick a winner for this contest, and fortunately, I don't have to, because that's the job of Kai Ryssdal, the host of Marketplace. And now, just in time for tax day, here is Kai. Hello, sir.
Hi, Kurt. How are you?
I'm good. So thanks again for doing this, judging for us. So what struck you about all these entries overall?
I think they pretty much broke down into about three categories. There were the people who did something artistic on the form itself. It could have been drawing or painting. There were a bunch of those. There were a bunch that manipulated the form to create something. I guess the word is that I would use is abstract. They created shapes or patterns or did things with the forms themselves, which were interesting. And then the category from which the runner-up and the winner came were people who actually made tangible things out of the form.
And they were
that's
craft.
Pretty much the way it broke
very,
down. Yeah, they were. That's right.
Crafty.
That's right.
And maybe most of them, more than I thought, actually commented on taxation or the IRS or the government. A lot of them did, but many didn't. They just used it as a medium.
Right. There were a fair number that were a medium. Although I have to tell you, there were a bunch that, you know, could they have drawn the middle finger on a tax form and set that in? They
yes.
would have done the same thing.
Yes.
You know what
there,
I mean?
No, there, were, there was there the one that I yeah. liked that was just a maze overlaid on the form,
right.
which was nice.
Right.
So you have a winner. But before we get to that
yes.
person, you also picked a runner-up. So who was that and what did that person make?
The runner-up is a woman by the name of Ruth Monig Steele. I hope I'm pronouncing that middle name correctly. She made out of, honestly, it's a countless number of tax forms, a bowl, literally
right.
a bowl. It,
right.
it actually sits on my desk. She mailed it to me directly and then I posted it up to Twitter. And I think it's going to become my spare change repository. I haven't decided yet.
You know, it's funny yeah. that you say that. It's an amazing thing. But I was thinking, okay, it doesn't have anything to do with taxes, really. But then I thought, yeah, spare change bowl.
That's exactly right. You know, I'm going to put money in this thing. And you know, sort of symbolically, I'm putting my money in the
yeah.
tax form.
Yeah. Right?
Anyway, yeah. So just to give a little description, because there's obviously a picture on the website. She rolled up a bunch of tax forms and formed them somehow using some kind of glue, I guess, into this bowl and then sprayed it with lacquer or shellac. And now it sits there in its entirety on my desk. So I thought that was cool, and that's why I picked that one.
And it was very cool. It was definitely, yeah. if in my mental short list, was on it. And your winner?
The winner is a woman by the name of Erin Farley. She made a dress out of tax forms. It's on a dressmaker's, a seamstress's dummy. I would actually say it's even a stylish dress. I could see people wearing this
yeah.
if it wasn't, you know, made out of paper and stuff. And I just thought it was great. And it got me literally right away.
She also had a quote attached. I like my money right where I can see it hanging
right,
in my closet,
right,
which is a line
right.
from Sex and the City. Somehow I didn't peg you as somebody who would respond to Carrie Bradshaw.
Well, so here's a teeny bit of the backstory. Project Runway is very popular in my house.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Maybe that's why it caught me. I don't know.
There you go. That makes sense. Well, we are going to give Erin Farley a call and let you give her the news.
Excellent.
Hello?
Hi. Is this Erin?
Yes, it is.
Hi. This is Kurt Anderson at Studio 360. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Great. And I want to thank you for entering the contest and sending us that picture of your dress. It was really impressive.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
And I've got a colleague here on the line who wants to ask you some things about it as well.
Hey, Erin, it's Kai Ryssdal, the host of Marketplace. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. So listen, I've got some news. Not only are you a finalist in this contest, but you actually won, hands down, going away.
Are you kidding? Wow, that's so exciting.
I am dead serious. Wow. Kurt and I were just talking about this before we got you on the phone. And I said, this was the first one as I was clicking through all the entries. I said, this is the one. This is it. So congratulations.
Oh, great. Wow. Thank you so much.
Which
Thank
isn't
you.
To say there aren't lots of other great entries. But
that is true.
There were.
But tell Erin, Kai, what you loved about her 1040 dress.
First of all, I thought it was actually stylish, right? I actually like the cut of the dress itself, which gets me to the real reason it caught my eye. Project Runway is huge in my house. My two younger children mm-hmm. and my wife and I sit there and watch all the time. And this mm-hmm. one just clicked with me right away. I thought it was really cool.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Yes, I'm a big fan of Project Runway as well. So,
well there you go. Now, are you a dressmaker, like, for real or what?
Well, so I used to live in New York City. I live in D.C. right now. And by day, I do research, criminal justice research. But kind of on a whim, just enrolled in the Fashion Institute of Technology, FIT, in New York.
Yeah.
And so I took about a year worth of classes. So I learned how to drape, and I learned better sewing skills and sketching and things like that.
I was curious. One of the things I really liked about the dress is that it wasn't just the paper. The bodice is, as I think we call it, blue, and the bottom of the skirt is sort of pinkish. How did those choices occur to you?
Well, so I wasn't sure exactly what the color would be when I printed it out, so I was very excited. So I just printed it on paper I stole from my office. Don't tell anyone.
I promise, but I need to ask you, did you finish the dress first or your taxes?
The dress, actually. My sister's an accountant, and so I actually made her do my taxes this year.
Well, Erin, I really thank you so much. It was a beautiful piece of work.
Congratulations.
Oh, wonderful. This is just very exciting. So thank you.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
So, Kai, when we asked you to do this, it was because of your financial renown and expertise. We had no idea you were also had a special interest in
and
knowledge
of fashion. I've got a little
flair.
I've got a little je ne sais quoi, I think you could say.
Absolutely. I'm grateful that you helped.
Absolutely happy to do it. Had a blast.
Excellent. You all can see Erin's winning dress, along with all of the finalists, at studio360.org. Your idea of what a Shakespearean actor sounds like probably comes from the likes of Laurence Olivier.
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Rather than, say, Ethan Hawke.
Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune.
Olivier just sounds more Shakespearean. But maybe, in fact, not. Maybe for the last 400 years, the pronunciation of English by English people has changed so much, it turns out we're actually missing the full flavor and the full meanings of Shakespeare's language. Anyhow, that's the theory of David and Ben Crystal, a father and son team of linguists, and Ben is also a successful Shakespearean actor. The Crystals have recreated what they say is original pronunciation, how Shakespeare's plays would have sounded around 1600. David and Ben Crystal, welcome to Studio 360.
Great to be here.
Nice to see you, Kurt.
So when did you and which of you decided to start figuring out the original pronunciation of Shakespeare?
Well, this all started, this is David, and this all started in 2004 when the telephone rings at home and it's Shakespeare's Globe in London. And the director there, Tim Carroll, wanted to put on a production of Romeo and Juliet in original pronunciation. The Globe, you see, is known for its attempt to reconstruct original practices, you know, original music, original costume, and so on.
Right.
So that's how it started. We did a Romeo and Juliet reconstruction in OP, as we call it, original pronunciation. It was very successful. And since then, the ball has started rolling.
I remember when Dad first started speaking to me about this almost 10 years ago, and he said, you know, I think we're probably about 80% right. And then a few years later, he said, you know what, I think we're actually about 90% right.
Yes.
And he's continuing his academic work on OP and refining that even still. And then on the other side of the fork, as it were, I've gone off and have been exploring it from a practitioner's point of view, and the effects that it has on a company, on the way that they move, on the speed of speech, and indeed the quality of Shakespeare performance that comes out of people when they use this accent.
Just so we can compare apples to apples, Ben, if you can remember it or know it, can you do that, the Hamlet soliloquy we started with?
Hamlet's to be or not to be in original pronunciation. It's the first few lines. To bear or not to bear, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sair troubles and by opposing, end them. To die, to sleep no more, and by a sleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished.
That's fantastic. In addition to being less portentous than any version of that I've ever heard, it sounds like most English people in 1600s spoke more like people in the north of England and Ireland do now. So essentially, the accent in the south of England was the one that modernized and became standard?
Well, that's right. The history of English accents is very interesting here. When we did this at the Globe, I spent the interval going around the audience and saying, what do you think? How do you recognize it? And everybody said, we speak like that where I come from. You know, and it didn't matter where they came from, whether they came from the north of England or Ireland or Scotland or even parts of America. They all said, we recognize that accent. And the reason, you see, is that this was the accent that led to many of these other accents. You know, the Irish and Scots and Northern and so on all developed out of it. And, of course, American accents too, because this is the accent that went across on the Mayflower, you see.
And later right. Australian.
And later Australia. Now, the received pronunciation that you heard earlier on with Laurence Olivier, this is a very late accent. It doesn't arrive in Britain, in England, until about the year 1800. It was a class accent, you see, when the new class system was developing, upper class, middle class, lower class, and the upper class people wanted to make sure they didn't sound like lower class people. Then that accent evolved and became the RP that we know today. But in Shakespeare's time, there was nothing remotely like received pronunciation.
In terms of going to see a Shakespeare play, it completely turns everything on its head. So the things that you were picking up there when you heard me do Hamlet's To Be or Not To Be, and you're saying it sounds a bit more colloquial and informal and that kind of thing. You think about the kind of theatrical dynamic that the Globe has, where the lights are on the audience and on the actors as well, and you can see each other, and there's a two-way dynamic. So they talk to the audience. It's a sort of time to ask your friend for help. You know, what do you think I should do? Do you think I should kill Claudius? Do you think I should believe the ghost? And you know, the audience would reply as well. So suddenly you've got a two-way dynamic. You're much more involved with the action rather than when this more sort of clipped and polite accent came in. The lights were off on the audience. They were observers on someone self-reflecting, and thereby you get this grander sort of, pedestal style of Shakespeare.
That's interesting. So this language helped make the fourth wall non-existent until it was invented sometime in the 19th century.
One of the things you have to appreciate when you are talking about accent is that accent doesn't exist independently of the rest of the body or even the rest of the stage. One of the most noticeable things that I saw when I was sitting in the rehearsal room at Shakespeare's Globe, and next to me was sitting the mistress of movement at the Globe there, Glyn MacDonald.
What a title.
Yes. I was master of original pronunciation, and she was mistress of movement. Wasn't it lovely? Anyway, we're watching the actors on the stage, and this was the first time she'd seen them since they'd learnt the accent. Now, they were already doing Romeo, you see, in the modern accent at the same time as they were doing it in OP. And she looked at me and said, they're moving differently. They're holding themselves differently. Now, the speed difference that we're talking about is quite significant. If I give you an example, when Romeo looks up at the gallery and says, "It," in modern English, it is my lady, oh, it is my love, oh, that she knew she were, that's about 6 seconds. Now, if you do it in OP, it comes out like this. It is my lady. Oh, it is me love. Oh, that she knew she were. That's about 4 seconds. Huh. Now, when you compare the OP Romeo with the modern Romeo, the OP version was 10 minutes shorter because of this speed issue. And that's a lifetime on stage, isn't it, Ben? I mean, 10 minutes shorter is amazing.
I mean, it's everything that you want from, you know, the Romeo and Juliet chorus when he says it's now the 2 hours traffic of our stage rather than the, you know, the 3 3/4 hours traffic.
It's so wonderfully counterintuitive, too, since we think, oh, now is the time of speed. And, of course, we're slower.
In a much more sort of, I suppose, in a very straightforward effect, you know, cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war. Mm-hmm. The line from Julius Caesar, you know, it's a wonderful line that. And, you know, in received pronunciation, it's cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war. And you sort of think, well, you know, one of the things that you want to do when you're working with actors on Shakespeare is encourage them to bring the colour out in words. Now, how to bring the colour out in the word war? How do you make it sound like war, you know? Well, it's already there for you in original pronunciation. Cry havoc and unleash the dogs of war, you know? What do you want to... Hello, I'm a dog of war. Chanted to meet you. Or, yes. I'm a dog of war.
Yeah. No, it makes all of the modern received pronunciation sound like a Monty Python sketch a bit.
A little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the kids in the audience at Shakespeare's Globe reacted in exactly that way. I met a group of inner city kids who spoke in a strong London accent as I was walking around. And I went up to them and I said, you know, how are you finding the play, guys? And they said, oh, it's great, they said, isn't it? It's great. And I said, why, what's so great about it? And they said, well, normally, they said, when we go to theatre, it sounds all posh. Whereas these people, they're speaking like us. Now, of course, the OP wasn't exactly like the way they were speaking, but it reached out to them in a way that made them feel it was a warmer connection than before.
The other astounding part of this is that it has apparently allowed you and us to unearth kind of archaeologically puns and jokes that were invisible to us heretofore. Talk about that.
Yeah, this is the thing. One of the questions I bet is in every listener's mind at the moment, unless they're specialists in linguistics, is how do you know? How do you know? How do you reconstruct? And the answer is very simple. You look very carefully at all the rhymes that don't work in modern English that do work in Shakespeare's day, and we can illustrate that in a second. And the next thing you do is you look at all the puns that don't work in modern English that did work in Shakespeare's day. Now, the rhymes are the first thing, before we get on to puns. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sonnets in particular, Ben,
they're supposed to rhyme, right?
They absolutely. Now, 96 of the sonnets don't rhyme perfectly, and you have to ask the question, well, why is that? Was Shakespeare not a very good poet then? Yeah.
And that's most of them, listeners, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. Out of the 154, that's a tremendous number. And the other thing is, you can't get out of it by saying, ah, well, these were I rhymes, you know, rhymes that looked right, even though they didn't sound right, because that wasn't the fashion of speaking in those days. No, the sonnets, and Ben, would you do one for us? Because that will illustrate the point perfectly.
Sure, well, the end rhyme of 116, if this be error and upon me proved, I never writ nor no man ever loved.
Which there we are. Proved and loved.
Proved and loved.
You know, They should rhyme. Now, the question academically is it proved and loved or proved and loved? Now, this is where I come in. I go looking at the sources and find that, for example, Ben Jonson, the dramatist, but he also wrote an English grammar, says when he, at the beginning of his grammar, he goes through all the letters of the alphabet, and when he gets to letter O, he says, we pronounce this word short, and he gives examples like glove, prov, love. So he tells us that it's short. So the real version is, Ben?
If this be Aaron upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man e'er loved.
That's fantastic. Ben, you have been leading workshops in the United States and all over the United Kingdom.
And I'm about to again.
Great. How do American actors do in picking up OP versus British? Is there any difference?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating, really, because, you know, Dad sort of, obviously, from an academic point of view, hates that final 10% that he can't fill.
Yeah.
And I've been trying to find a way to turn it to my advantage. So, you know, there's an element in that, you know, my original pronunciation is original pronunciation to 90%. And then that last 10% is, well, I was born near London, so this is my sort of natural spoken accent. And then I grew up in North Wales, and then I went to university in Lancaster, and then I came back down to London, so I got a bit of Cockney as well. And I spent a lot of time traveling around the world, so I got a bit of a transatlantic thing. So my original pronunciation is 90% OP, and then 10% filled with me, you know, the very essence of my sort of accent background. And so it makes speaking Shakespeare, you know, a company who's all speaking in OP, they all sound pretty much the same, but at the same time, they have an ownership over it that, you know, is quite unlike any other. Now, when I was working with the Rena Whites on Hamlet, and I'm about to go to Houston next week to work with a company on Julius Caesar, there are parts of the accent that are more natural to them, you know, like the strong R or whatever that's very inherent to modern American.
Although not necessarily Texas.
No, well, not necessarily in Texas, okay. But interesting,
or Boston, for that matter.
Yeah.
But interestingly, you know, the thing is, you know, people say, oh, well, you know, you think that all plays should be done in the Globe and all, you know, we should be in Doublet and Hose and all speak in original pronunciation. And, you know, I was working with an actor who was struggling with Oberon, and he had to do the speech, flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in apple of his eye. And the rhymes don't work. And I said, well, you know, they do in OP. Flora of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink blink an apple of his eye. Uh-huh. Now, does that mean that, you know, forevermore we should do it in OP? No, it works brilliantly in Southern American. Flower this purple dye, hippie cupid's archerite, zinc an apple of his eye. You know, as long as you can speak it in an accent that fits, that's all that's needed, really.
Do you guys ever just joke around and talk to each other in OP? Do this dialogue from Star Wars or something? I don't know.
all the time.
Absolutely right.
And tea time at the Crystals.
Yes. But this is a very important thing. When you're working with the actors, as I did at the Globe, and I think you did also in Reno, Ben, that's one of the things I tell them to do when they leave each other at the end of the evening. I tell them, don't say good night to each other. Say good night. You know, get into the habit of using your OP, ordering a pint of beer in the pub or whatever it is. Do it in OP and make it become second nature to you. Very important strategy.
Second nature.
Second nature, yes.
David and Ben Crystal, thank you so much. This was just a pleasure.
Likewise.
And ours too. Thanks, Kurt.
You can find out more about original pronunciation, like how Shakespeare hid some very naughty puns in his verse, by listening to my full conversation with the Crystals, father and son, at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour, we will go behind the scenes of an incredibly ambitious production. It's part theater, part dance, part art installation, part theme park, all inspired by Macbeth, but with one big twist.
How do we do the full Macbeth, but you don't hear any of the language? The language gets absorbed into the space, into the intention, but ultimately it's a silent film.
Evoking the great writer, but without words. That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. And today's show is all about how Shakespeare lives, 400 years after he shuffled off this mortal coil.
Studio 360, enjoy your stay at the McKittrick.
A few years ago, I went to an old building in Chelsea, one of New York's art gallery districts, to see something that I'd heard a lot about. Inside, the lobby lounge looks like it's in the 1930s.
What can I get for you, sir?
I'm actually here to see a play, or anyway, to immerse in a playish experience. It's a production by the British company Punch Drunk, but no one will tell me what is about to happen, other than that it's based on Macbeth, loosely. The show's called Sleep No More.
Please down your cocktails, because you can't bring them with you. Please step right over here.
Punch Drunk are pioneers in immersive theater. They took 100,000 square feet of warehouse space, 2.5 acres, and turned that into this meticulously detailed world, a kind of Macbeth theme park with no signage or maps or instructions.
These are your masks for this evening.
I'm handed a mask, white plastic, kind of sinister looking. The elevator goes up, and then at level 3... the doors open. And I'm inside a living room. It's dimly lit, atmospheric. The walls are lined with mirrors and faded photographs of children. I walk through a doorway and then stumble into a graveyard, real dirt crunching beneath my feet. I round the corner and now I'm in a bedroom. And there's a man and woman dancing, this passionate, almost violent duet. Nobody speaks, but I believe I've found Mr. and Mrs. Macbeth. I leave them and step into a dark courtyard that's draped in fog.
Now we're in the grounds of the hotel, and it's sort of decaying Victorian walled garden.
That is the show's creator, Felix Barrett, who seems more like Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream than anybody out of Macbeth.
The disease and rot that's at the core of their relationship becomes evident out here. It's Lady Macbeth's playground, beautifully indicative of Blackheart.
for as long as I want, 45 minutes, an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever, I will follow Lady Macbeth or the other characters around their dreamy world. It's a giant-sized theatrical version of Choose Your Own Adventure. It's intensively imagined and truly mysterious.
For me, it's most important that audience members feel like they're lost. Almost that moment of panic where you think, am I in the right place? Have I strayed too far?
Yes, I was lost most of the time, so you succeeded.
The original challenge with this was, how do we do the full Macbeth, but you don't hear any of the language. The language gets absorbed into the space, into the intention, but ultimately it's a silent film.
Yes. How many floors do you have here?
There are six floors.
Really? And 100,000 square feet now?
Yeah. But some of the spaces not everyone can access. The sixth floor, you can only get in if you're by yourself.
Really?
And you're very lucky. Fate will have a hand in that.
Interesting. So it's New York. Of course there's a VIP room. Yeah. Lead the way.
So, if we come through here. Here we are in the foyer, the lobby of the McKittrick Hotel.
Suggested by old phone booths and old furniture and...
It's slightly run down. It's almost... half it's been locked up for the winter.
Do you have a year in mind that... we are in during
1938,
the show?
Sort of, the peak of film noir.
Yeah.
And we're in Scotland.
And this is inspired by Macbeth and a take on Macbeth. And we don't have any problem, unlike a regular theater where you can't say Macbeth, we don't say the Scottish play.
Well, very interesting. We actually actively embrace it because I think one of our big design concepts for the whole building, all 100 rooms, is that...
100 rooms, really?
Yeah, is that superstition for us is at the core of the text. And the idea that these portents and omens are in the air. And, there's witchcraft and, the dark arts are everywhere. So every single space has some sort of superstition within it. Either it's something that's preventative and it's almost like it wards off evil and protects against witches, which means that our witches can't actually enter. Or it's something that's a curse. It's almost the hex upon the space that's actually sucking the darkness in.
So this is where the hotel is most hotel-like.
It's the breakfast room around the corner here. You can see, actually, in terms of the superstition here, there's the silver is...
hundreds of cubby holes, some of which have cutlery formed into crosses, for instance.
And they're in piles of salt, because, again, that's just a substance that protects against witches.
And now when you come here at night during a performance, there were people eating lunch or breakfast or whatever they're doing, and then start to interact in these strange, choreographed, silent... ways.
Yeah, the action is largely contemporary dance.
And improvised?
Actually nothing in the show is improvised.
Really?
At 8:05 every evening, we'll know exactly where everyone is in the building.
Really?
Yeah.
So all the embraces and climbing up walls and all the rest, that's...
Totally so. Every single gesture, every single action has been rehearsed.
So we've seen two of 100 rooms. Let's see some more.
Let's go upstairs to... So this is Lady Macbeth's bedroom in the orangery, sort of the most exclusive, luxurious wing of the hotel. Grand bed, it's the marital suite. The key scene here probably is the persuasion. It's her actually forcing him to do the deed.
And by the way, an old-fashioned bathtub full of what looks to be bloody water.
Yeah, the water at the top of the show starts clean. But after murdering Duncan, the water's very red by the end. So now we've just walked through the vegetable patch that's in the grounds of the McKittrick.
It seems to be a graveyard.
Well, it kind of, it's half
piles
graveyard.
Piles of dirt with crosses, I'd say graveyard. But.
Yeah. And here, we're now in the guardsman's cottage on the estate. And this is the home of the Macduffs.
This begins one of these smaller domestic spaces that is so intensely decorated with objects, books and flowers and teacups and crucifixes, and I could go on and on. People, audience members, can and do go examine individual things and pull a book off the shelf, and that's okay, right?
Yeah, it's crucial that if you want to, you can go up and scrutinize. And actually, if we move down here, there are sort of... every single drawer that you see, you can open and you can interrogate. Right. You would open these drawers. Aha. So there's a black and white photograph of an infant in a circle of salt with the character of Lady Macduff. Her mild paranoia about her infants has turned into borderline lunacy.
And here on the wall are dozens of really old, yellowed newspaper magazine clippings pinned to the wall, along with religious artifacts, photographs. I mean, the density of material and choice made about why is this text here and what does this mean? Yeah. And does it mean anything?
Yeah, we've got a huge team of people led by Beatrice Minns who work on the detail, from letter writing to sourcing these right quotes. So these actual Bible references that are used as preventative charms. What's this one? St. Christopher, that his mercies might instruct the Christ in my heart to open heavenwards and receive thy spirit, for to know in the unity of the saints the love. And that's all we get. That's a scrap. Should we go upstairs?
Sure, whatever you say. So here we're in the one of the more clearly spooky places, a hospital ward, an asylum ward, something that has a crucifix over each plain, depressing white metal bed.
And this is where, when Lady Macbeth goes mad and is driven crazy by the actions, she ends up and spends the last of her days.
Because there are 100,000 different versions of this, of Sleep No More, that can be experienced, I know I've had conversations with every friend of mine who I've discovered has seen it, saying, oh, did you see this? Or what did you do there? And did you see that? And so comparing notes. But I've also seen that there are people online trying to amass their knowledge in a kind of wiki way. Does that bug you?
Actually, it does. It's very strange. That's the only difference between an American audience and an English audience. That I think here there's a sense that it's a puzzle that can be solved, and they're trying to work out the logic so that you could almost create a sort of master plan which we have, you know, at 8:05, Lady Macduff will be in the ballroom with a candlestick. And there's a desire for people to make sense of that.
Yeah.
When I think it's an English audience, strangely, it's almost go the other way, and they just...
They don't want to demystify anything.
They don't want to demystify, yeah.
Well, thank you, Felix. This is fantastic.
Thank you very much.
I hope you run for as long as you want to run.
Thanks. Pleasure.
Good. Pleasure indeed. My farewell wish there to Felix that his show would have a long run. That came true, and then some. I visited the McKittrick in 2011, just after Sleep No More opened, and it's still going. You can see pictures of some of the rooms we visited at studio360.org. And parting is such sweet sorrow. This edition of Studio 360 has come to a close. We'll be back with a new show next week, and you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Studio 360 Show, and I'm at KB Anderson with an EN. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frassica,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Tommy Bazarian,
Danielle Fox,
Afi Yellowdeep,
Kate Essick.
Thanks for listening.
Ophelia, she's neath the window. For her, I feel so afraid. On her 22nd birthday, she already is an old maid.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, it was just an offhand comment.
And I said, what you really need is sexual healing.
Which turned into one of the greatest songs ever. When I get that feeling, I want sexual healing. The unlikely story behind Marvin Gaye's R&B classic. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. So